Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with Patrick Martins. And it's Sunday at Roberta's. Brunch is being served at 261 Moore Street. We are going to be talking in a few minutes with Fern Estro, who is a registered dietitian and founder of the FGE Food and Nutrition Team. We're going to talk about the Farm Bill. And then our next guest in the second half will be Dan Izzo from Lupa, talking about chefs and Farm Bill materials as well. So we'll be back in just a second with more on the Farm Bill. Isn't that nice?
Yeah. Anyway, here we are back. Sorry we're late. Looks like Fern fell. And anyway, she's on a cab, so she's on her way back.
We could phone her or she'll be here in a few minutes.
I'm very excited about some of the stuff that's happening with Heritage Foods. First of all, the Heritage Meat Shop is really taking off. If any of our listeners are near the Essex Street Market, that's 120 Essex Street on the corner of Essex and Delancey, should definitely go down. Where my favorite person is Dionisio Silva, who is actually the butcher at Jeffrey's. And Jeffrey's was the stand that we took over. Jeffrey's market had been there for 70 years, 70 years. So they ended up closing about 8 months ago, and we opened 3 days ago. And we have an unbelievable selection of charcuterie and all this kind of fresh stuff, goat. And we really encourage everyone to go down and meet the crew. I also want to give a shout out to Daniel Honig, who is a very young man, but who had real initiative to kind of pull that shop together and deal with the city of New York, the EDC, to get that market started for us. Essex Market is just such a great energy in there. I mean, it's a big public market. It looks weird from the outside, but on the inside, it's very, very beautiful. And Fiorello LaGuardia, the mayor in New York in the 30s, actually started that market to get pushcart vendors off the streets. So anyway, it's all very exciting. Go to the store. We have a $3.99 special on fresh meats.
You have some very fancy charcuterie there. Why don't you talk about a little bit about some of the people who are supplying you? Because you've got some great chefs working with this.
We have, basically we sell pig parts to various cures around the country, and they end up then selling us the charcuterie for an exorbitant price back to us. And then we sell it at the shop. But we have Armandino Batali. We have Sila Maria Bellese, Mark Buzio. We have the great ham cures of the South, Al Benton from Tennessee, Colonel Nancy Newsom from Kentucky and Sam Edwards from Virginia, who's also a sponsor on the network. So, yeah, really unbelievable charcuterie. And we're very proud that Cesare Caselle from Salù Maria Rossi on 73rd and Columbus has actually made some delicious sweet and spicy soppressata using our red wattle pig shoulders. So that's very exciting. So
who were we just talking? Oh, Damian Sansonetti was talking last week about how much he loves the red wattle pig.
Yeah, no, it's everyone's favorite. In other news, No Goat Left Behind. I don't know how many of our listeners know about that project, but essentially, in order to have babies, a mother constantly has to have babies. That's the only way that she's able to produce milk, and in the dairy, producing milk is the key to the whole operation. So with all these babies being born, there's actually ends up being absolutely no use for any of the males, which is really, you know, sad because, you know, men don't have a place on dairy farms other than, of course, as breeders. But 99% of the males are useless on dairy farms. So, it's actually very, very sad. Most of those male goats are either killed at birth or they're sold on to a commodity market where they live in very unsanitary and unhealthy environments. And what really makes that absurd is that meanwhile, so far this year in 2011, we have imported 17 million pounds of goat meat from Australia and New Zealand.
Incredible.
So here we are, you know, in a country that, you know, believes in, anti-stem cell research, and there's this whole kind of religious puritanical thing, and yet one of the five major livestock species, the goat, is basically being killed at birth and not given the chance to, you know, live its life and kind of carry on the way, you know, people would argue in this country, the way God intended. So we have organized an unbelievable campaign thanks to Erin Fairbanks, who has a show on this network called The Farm Report. She also works at Heritage Foods, and she basically partnered us with about 14 goat dairies around Vermont and New York State, also in Iowa and Kansas. And we basically asked these people to not kill their male goats and to raise them, you know, to adulthood and let them kind of live the humane life that they deserve. And so now we have 500 goats to sell, and thanks a little bit to our home consumers via mail order, but mostly thanks to these amazing chefs. We've been able to get commitments to 500 goats. So this week, we're actually going to be coming out with a press release announcing these 70 restaurants, mainly in New York, but all throughout the country and in Northern California, and encourage our listeners to go to these restaurants and try goat meat. It's absolutely tender and delicious, like lamb. It's very nutritious, and it's very, very tasty. And I encourage everyone to go to these restaurants. And
we can announce on air now that the month of October will forever now be known as the month of Goat-tober.
Goat-tober, that's right, Jack. Thank you. And once they change that officially in the Library of Congress, we'll announce that. Because it is very powerful. Goat is a seasonal food.
It is the most widely consumed protein in the world, though, outside of the United States and Northern Europe.
It is. It absolutely is. So I really also just look forward to going to these restaurants and seeing how the chefs are going to deal with goats. Minetta Tavern, that's one example of a restaurant. They're buying 4 goats a week throughout the month of October. Union Square Cafe is buying 4 goats a week. You know, other restaurants that don't have the real infrastructure for that, you know, they're buying 2 goats once, you know, on 1 week. So anyway, go to the Heritage Foods USA website or heritageradionetwork.com, and you'll be able to see about all those restaurants that are going to have, you know, goat right up there with beef and chicken and pork. So very, very exciting. And then I also...
What about turkeys, Patrick? You haven't said anything about turkeys, but yeah, it's time for people to start thinking about that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they're on sale on our website. It's just that with this No Goat Left Behind, trying to move 50,000 pounds of goat or whatever 500 times 40 is, you know, it's very, very difficult to think also ahead to turkeys. But, you know, we have our usual accounts. I mean... Pastis and Balthazar, Danielle and Barb Balud and Ottomanelli and Sons, and on the West Coast, Prather Ranch. Oh, of course, I should mention Fairway. So, you know, there are a lot of places that just buy every year, and I think hopefully that'll all fall into place.
Well, consumers should be placing orders, too, so that you know how many you're going to have.
Yeah, it's funny. People forget that, you know, for a turkey farmer, the turkey season really begins in February and March when they start to buy the little baby poults. And now, actually, they see, you know, if they were to look out their window, our turkey farmers see, you know, tens of thousands of, you know, large 20-pound turkeys, 25-pound turkeys eating a buttload of feed. So, actually, turkey is has its highest, you know, ecological footprint right now. So, yeah, people should be thinking about that.
Absolutely.
And finally, before we deal with Fern, who is in a taxi, a couple quotes. We also just came out with our beautiful Heritage Foods USA mail order catalog. It's our seasonal catalog. We come out with one a year. It's going to be online soon, but our very own Andrea Trabuco Campos, the director of mail order for Heritage, did it, and it's really, really beautiful. There are a couple of quotes he put on the covers, which I thought I would read. "We believe the best way to help family farmers is to buy from them." Such a simple idea, and yet one that I think I came from the nonprofit world. I mean, it seems to me that 98% of nonprofits in food world forget that that's the goal. Buy from small family farms. They get in other things and sometimes a little off focus, but how much money is put into the hands of farmers is, you know, certainly the number one priority. Then there's another one. This is from Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food. "Taste like identity has value only when there are differences." And I really, really like that idea of, you know, the importance of preserving diversity in the food supply. So there I am with my little 14-minute self-promotion, aggrandizing promotion of Heritage Foods. And it looks like Fern has survived the taxi and is on her way in. So we'll take a short break and come back with this edition of The Main Course.
We're back. This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiever, with Patrick Martins. And Jack, do we have Fern on the phone?
She is one block away.
Okay. So we're going to be talking about the Farm Bill, so why don't we just give a little advance direction about that. Fern has been working on the Farm Bill. She's been the author of several sort of position papers about it on the Food Systems NYC website. She is a registered dietitian and the founder of the FGE Food and Nutrition Team. She consults to governments, agencies, organizations, educational institutions, and communities on food and nutrition policy. So she's been a guest on the show before. She was here about a year ago, and we had a really interesting conversation about the debate on the Farm Bill. And now that things are really heating up with the Farm Bill, we are having her back so that we can talk a little bit about some of the nitty-gritty things. I think that most people think the Farm Bill is all about entitlements to big agriculture, to corn, soybean, cotton, and so forth. Actually, the Farm Bill, of the $284 billion that the Farm Bill accounts for in the federal government budget, $188.9 billion of that goes to nutrition titles. And that includes things like SNAP, which is otherwise known as food stamps, as well as school nutrition programs, that's school lunch. So there are a lot of community organizations that benefit from the Farm Bill, not just agriculture alone. But it is absolutely the truth that the Farm Bill does put a lot of money into the pockets of people who don't really need it. And even some small farmers will say, you know, you know, I don't get why my neighbor who's growing corn is making 500 grand a year for basically growing something that doesn't really feed people, but really goes into ethanol and you know, other programs that don't necessarily produce nutritional food for school children, for instance, and so on. And then the other thing that I noticed recently, I don't know if you saw this, Patrick, but corn and corn syrup, most of the products that corn, these big corn crops go for, actually go into snack foods in the form of chips, candy, soft drinks. And basically, the U.S. Public Interest Group released last Wednesday a review of agricultural subsidies called Apples to Twinkies, which I urge people to take a look at, that shows that since 1995, approximately $16.9 billion in taxpayer, that's your and my money, have gone towards the supplementing of four of the country's most common food additives, and those would be corn syrup, high fructose corn syrup, corn starch, and soy oils. So it'll be interesting to discuss exactly what changes in the subsidy programs are going to have an effect on snack food manufacturers.
Also, I mean, what is it? Why do lobbyists? I mean, I understand that lobbyists are always going to lobby. I mean, that's their job. But why do senators and House of Representatives vote for these? I mean, a lot of these are scumbags. I mean, they're the lowest. They're promoting unhealth and lack of sanity and all this, but they're just putting money towards it. Is it just money? They need money to get elected, and that's it?
I think that's probably pretty close to the full answer on that question. I mean, I think that they think that corn is not just about, you know, making corn chips and so on. Corn is something that we export widely throughout the world as a feed crop and also as additives for other companies in other countries who are starting to follow suit with American manufacturing models and making a lot of crummy chips and whatnot as well for their populations. So
they'll pay like a Mitt Romney or something, and Mitt Romney will be like, hey, I got $300,000 for these, so I'm going to allow, you know, saturated fats into the schools
I'm going to vote for the subsidies because these guys are my friends, and because corn is a huge export crop, and because food manufacturers really rely on it, and these guys are also giving a lot of money to my campaign. It was interesting. There's another new thing that came into that's coming out of the farm bill, and that's the Food Safety Improvement Act, which is a brand new, or the Food Safety Modernization Act, excuse me, which is a brand new entitlement that is part of the farm bill, and that's to ramp up food safety, especially in meatpacking plants, but also across the board. And I noticed the other day that Michelle Bachmann took herself a photo op in an Iowa meat processing plant, and she was saying these new regulations are just going to put meatpacking business out of business altogether. They'll never be able to compete under these circumstances.
This is the woman whose husband tries to reform gay men from being gay, right?
Exactly. Okay, that's the one. Sure. Just to be clear. And meanwhile, she's in this meatpacking thing. She has, as Temple told us last week, you know, the industry has cleaned up a lot, and you're supposed to wear, like, you know, gear on your feet, gear, a hairnet, all of that kind of stuff. This woman is in there in her sandals. No coat on, no hairnet, no nothing. I mean, when I went to that Cargill plant last year, I mean, I was fully equipped with appropriate garb so that none of my microbes would be infiltrating or bringing pathogens into the meatpacking plant. So clearly she doesn't take
She's also
safety all that seriously.
Anti-science.
She is.
She doesn't believe that gayness is something people are born with, right?
Right.
She, she's probably anti-evolution, you know?
I think
these people are anti-science, so...
Well, she's not alone.
Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you know, to be anti-science is absurd. It crosses party lines. So you're going to ask in the 6 minutes we'll have with Fern, you're going to ask about...
Not a whole lot, but we'll make something happen.
Fern, there you are. Thank you so much.
I am so sorry. Here I am, yes.
Okay, so Fern, one of the questions I wanted to talk to you about in terms of the Farm Bill and ethanol subsidies was that this past spring, several members of Congress called for an end to the ethanol subsidies. Will this give some play in the budget to support alternative forms of agriculture? Do you think that will encourage smaller farmers to believe they'll get more subsidization themselves?
There's going to be, you know, money is going to be coming from somewhere, and that's it's a question mark. It's a possibility, but there are, you know, the problem we have is getting them, you know, is it the same farmers who are growing the subsidies for ethanol and for, question is food versus energy to a great degree, sadly, in that conversation. So you start into that, the whole soy corn conversation and feeding animals. And the feeding animals, you know, this is the complication of commodities that's so often so difficult for people to understand, in that commodities, the way we are structured, there are problems, but it is not entirely a one-line deal. You've got different groups we're talking about right now. If we could get the commodities line for our small farmers, more directed to our small farmers, and give them perhaps more diversity in what they could grow, the certain results are sometimes limited. A good example might be the tobacco situation that happened when we got the tobacco rulings years ago. Those farmers learned to grow different things, from animal livestock to strawberry fields.
Right. So in other words, they retooled.
That's the kind of infusion we need to see, that support to the farmer, the smaller farmer. Because, well, some of the, I mean, and those farmers, they're coming along.
Yeah.
I mean, down there, I mean, in North Carolina, South Carolina, you know, they've got a food policy council, a group they've been working with for quite a while. And this is just a very important part to understand. So, yes, there's a possibility, but we have to help them understand that it's successful. We've proven it's successful. Those states have turned it around. They're the proof.
Right. Because one of the things, I was talking to Ian Cheney a few weeks ago, and he was saying that it's not so easy for somebody who grows a commodity crop to just throw in the towel and suddenly start growing row crops. And I think that's what you're addressing there with this analogy with the tobacco farmers.
You can't just cut it off. And that's what most people are having a really hard time understanding, is it just, yes. Our small farmers also do get commodities dollars.
They do?
Yeah, they do. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not only the guys. So at this point, what I think we really need to really be able to try to help them understand is that we need to look maybe at some history of what's worked. Because that, I would say, from a food perspective, a nutrition perspective, I happen to be an RD, I certainly want to see more healthful crops. I'm not saying we shouldn't grow soy or corn or some of the other commodity crops, but let's direct it to some of the areas where we really could use, i.e. certain produce and the like, and then address some of the other issues, of course, having to do with healthy food.
Right.
When we engage in this process, we're helping people learn good practices. I have a couple of friends in North Carolina. Ida Beatty and her husband have a farm down in North Carolina. They've got goats, strawberries, they've got trees. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've turned it around. Oh, and by the way, and I say this not to, this is a point, if they happen to be, and this, it's not a point, major discussion, but they happen to be black farmers.
Right.
These are really hard-working people. Ada and Al, and they've taken advantage of what they can.
Right.
This is what we need to do.
It is, absolutely. One last question, Fern, and then I think we're going to have to, unfortunately, move on to our next guest. But
Don't we have until 12:40?
Oh, so sorry.
Says,
okay,
yeah.
Good. I thought you said You're 6 minutes. The U.S. Public Interest Research Group released their Apples to Twinkies report on Wednesday. Did you read that?
And I heard the Twinkies and I heard the release. And I have a feeling I know the question again, but say it again.
Okay. But anyway, so the U.S. Public Interest Research Group released a report called Apples to Twinkies, identifying approximately $16.9 billion in taxpayer money going towards supplementing four of the country's most common food additives, largely corn products. Now, what changes to the farm bill would have an impact on those figures? In other words, like, how can we send a message to Congress saying, I don't really want my taxpayers' dollars to be going towards making Twinkies?
One of the things I want to do, and I've actually reached out to a few people on this, and it's that I think the number is very real in many ways, but I do feel we do need to separate out, and I will be happy to share that with you when I get the response, about how much, how do they separate it? How do they figure out separation between what was going into fast food and what was going into, for example, feed corn or energy? Back to the same conversation. If we're talking about corn syrup and all that crap, you know what I mean?
Right.
That's the problem. Are they talking about, because I don't, and that's the only question I have there. I think that report is a very important report. I think there's a lot to be valued in it. I think that a little more explanation about how they arrived at those figures is important.
Uh-huh.
Because I think that is where we must... We need to understand it's the whole thing going back to commodities. When people talk about it being school food, commodities are only part of school food. The commodities title is only part of school food.
Right.
Commodities title, school food is food child nutrition authorization.
Right.
And it does impact school food, but it is not all of school food. So likewise here, I think it's a similar situation. This is a, what are we talking about? And how much of that corn is designated for sweeteners for processed foods, or are we starting to calculate the CAFOs that are producing the pigs that are used for the, you know, product or the beef, do you follow what I'm saying, and the feed that goes there as part of the process chain?
Right.
I just want to, and these are, I know they're detailed questions, we all know this is complicated, but we don't like to often talk about it being complicated.
No, the public likes things to be very much in black and white. And certainly I find this very complicated. I mean, I think the Farm Bill is an extraordinarily complicated piece of legislation. And I think that there are so many different, aspects to it that don't get a lot of media play. But I wanted to ask you, like, in your work as an activist, what do you see as some of the major changes that you hope to affect in the Farm Bill, in the coming Farm Bill 2012?
I think it's critical that we hold on to infrastructure. Sadly, there is no more money in D.C. Mm-hmm. There's no more money anywhere as of now. And I think what's going on this week in Washington is very sad and only going to hurt us more. Certainly the world markets have been pretty crazy and that, you know, so what we need to do is recognize and work towards the infrastructure, maintaining what is critical,
mm-hmm.
building for the future so that what we have is cost neutral. So that's why your question before was very, very vital. You know, keep it in, you know, let's keep it helping and supporting the country and how. And then the other part of it is, what can we build in that's cost neutral that will allow us to build for the future? Because if we don't think in terms of the future, and this is where so much of the damage was done in previous years, we will not get out of this. Our youth are critical. They need to be engaged in these conversations. They need to understand the conversation. We should not exclude them. We should not exclude the older population either. We mm-hmm. want the history. People need to go back and reflect. This is happening. You know, this is not a first.
Right.
I mean, you know, it not, and why are we not learning from our mistakes?
I don't think that's something as a nation that we do generally.
And then, well, we don't, but the thing is, in terms of the legislation specifically, what would we do in infrastructure, I think our sectors need to find common ground.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really hard, because you've got a lot of organizations getting a lot of money from very large corporations that are involved in commodities, food engagements, and, you know, it's the whole of the conversation, and they're trying to feed. We're going to have more and more hungry people coming up.
Yeah, I mean, the population growth that's projected for the next 20 years or so is another, 9 billion people on the planet?
And it's funny, because I grew up in when the conversation was zero population growth. Tell you how old I am, I guess.
No, I don't think so.
There was, you know, and I'm not saying we should go back to what China did or anything like that, but mm-hmm. there are realities that we need to start thinking about. And that is another, you know, conversation. Population truly is a factor.
It is, and I think that, you know, but it's a fact also that Western Europe and the United States do almost have zero or negative population growth, and those big numbers that are posting in population are really coming from developing countries. And that's where, you know, there are all sort of literacy and birth control or, you know, education issues that are not being addressed.
Part of the reality is, you know, nature's been very, very strong at ensuring some balance. And, you know, we keep trying to overcome nature. We keep thinking, we figured it out. And then we find, oh, we didn't. We didn't figure it out this time. What happens, I don't want to see AIDS destroy a community. I don't want to see MRSAs or other Ebola viruses, but historically a lot of things like that are what kept populations in check.
Right.
And disease was a reality, and I don't want to see that disease, but if we're going to be responsible human beings, we have to look at both sides. If we're going to start saving lives and helping people to live longer, people need to support some of the things that maybe address some of the issues of birth control. And I appreciate there are religious components to that and personal, and I'm not telling anyone what to do.
Right.
But I think it's a consideration, and I think if people have children, they need to think about what world are they leaving to their children and perhaps encourage. I mean, I work with Head Start.
Right.
And I mean, our children are learning about food. They have chef hats, and we're getting farmer hats in. I'll take donations. things that, you know, I'm growing spinach in my apartment in Manhattan. It's a local variety, but it's fine. And I wouldn't want to plant it outside necessarily because I really don't want to see it taking over. But these are some of the things that, you know, help children become familiar with our farmland and future. But parents are not thinking of the future of their children. Oftentimes, when they have the children, they're thinking of the future of raising the children.
Right.
But not beyond that. And that is also the way society tends to think.
Yes, I think so. I think thinking beyond what's left over for the next generation, you might think about what's happening now, but yeah, really hard to imagine, I think.
And that's
people.
A very Native American, actually, process, 7 generations out.
Oh, really?
Yep. In an indigenous community in the United States, when the decision is made, it's made with consideration of the upcoming 7 generations. I believe in many tribes, I can't say all.
Wow, I had no idea, Fern. That's worth investigating further. Let me ask you one more question, and then we'll probably take our leave of you. But I did want to ask one thing about the response in Congress to President Obama's proposals for changes in farm policy. And it drew a lot of criticism from Republicans on the House and Senate Agricultural Committees, specifically his call for a reduction in crop insurance programs. And I was kind of surprised by that. Won't that hurt small farmers too? I mean, how does that work? Because crop insurance seems to be great for the big guys. But
it's a critical problem for most of us. Well, the thing is, crop insurance doesn't exist in a practical way for most of our small farmers. I mean, again, we get into a little bit of splitting hairs here, but if you're talking about an organic farmer, for example, mm-hmm. versus a conventional farmer, versus a GMO farmer, I'm into all of it. The price that they get back on is not what they've been selling it at.
Yeah.
It's based on the commodities price.
Right.
So that has nothing to do with what they were actually earning as income. If I take a job in the federal government at a grade 15, I get it's something around 25% increase in the baseline of what they're marketing across the country because I live in New State, for example, or if I live in New York.
Mm-hmm.
These are serious considerations in terms of what we talk about in terms of insurance is that seasonality, locality, you know, corn, you know, strawberries are in April in Louisiana.
Yeah.
And they're June in New York.
Right.
You know, this is a regional conversation, sadly, to some degree. How do we structure the crop insurance so it's realistic, so it really works? And that, I don't think we've actually done enough analysis. or we've talked enough of the small farmers.
Uh-huh.
Usually what I get from the small farmers is a lot of frustration. And we've had a lot of, and sadly, if next week we don't have, the city that doesn't pull it together, the funds
right.
that would have come out of FEMA, which are not specifically what we're talking about, but would affect our small farmers as well, because if people don't have money to buy food, our farmers are going to get hurt.
Yeah, sure.
And if people can't put their houses back together, you know, it's just, the trickle-down effect is huge. That's the problem.
Right. Fern, I have to wrap it up now because my next guest is here. But thanks so much for joining us, even by phone, and I hope you feel okay.
I will see you in a few moments.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You don't know what love is. You think that it's a toy, a pretty little game played by a girl and boy. You won't talk about it. You don't even care. And you just take for granted I'll always be there. You play, you stay away.
Man, am I sad that that band broke up. It was a family band called Cherry Homes. They were really good, but... And she was great, that singer. But I'm really excited to have a guy who I've talked on the phone with probably, 500 times every Monday and Tuesday and probably two or three other times a week if something's up. Dan Izzo from Lupa Restaurant. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Is this your first time? This is your first time in the studio, isn't it?
It's my first time at Roberta's and over here
really?
In general, yeah.
So let's talk about transition. We'll talk about good transitions since we've had none so far on this show. Tell us, from the chef's perspective, does the Farm Bill have any effect on New York chefs? Like, because I almost view yourselves as a collective group, a Farm Bill of your own.
Right. Yeah. I don't think directly, maybe more of an indirect effect on us, but I think the Farm Bill has an effect on everybody who's involved in food and, not necessarily... completely involved in food hands-on like we are. But yeah, of course it does. It affects us through all the farmers that we try to use, the markets and all that stuff and purveyors and whatnot. So
I just wonder, because, from my perspective, is Heritage Foods USA still mentioned on the bottom of the Lupa menu?
It absolutely is, yeah.
Very nice. That's such an honor.
Yeah.
It just seems like my experience with your restaurant group, at that time it was Mark Ladner,
yep.
Zach Allen, Jason Denton. This is way back
yep.
when they came, and through Joe and Mario, of course, they ended up just literally starting a supply that now is, 200 pigs a week. So
right.
it just seems like they're their own farm bill. Like
yeah.
they want to help. Grain
yeah.
prices go up, they go up. You
right.
know, they're just like immune to it because they're their own independent orbit,
yeah.
their own market. So anyway, that's why I was interested to see Farm Bills and Chef World. But back now to why you're on the show. What is your role at Lupa exactly? Give us a week in the life.
A week
Dan
in the
Izzo.
Life of a sous chef at Lupa. It's busy. It's a juggling act. It's all mm-hmm. kinds of things. It's ordering, doing the schedule. Daily specials, menu changes, that whole thing. Sometimes it requires you to be a babysitter, for grown adults. But that's the life of a sous chef. You're nonstop all the time, and you're trying to juggle six different things at once. And if you're not organized, you're not gonna do well. That's the concrete of it. If you're not organized. You're going down.
So what do you do? Is your time mainly in the kitchen, mainly downstairs, prepping?
I'd say right now it's more managerial stuff, half and half, I guess. Prepping, coming up with specials, it's the fall season now, so we just got through with menu changes. But once we get all that stuff settled in, then it's paperwork and it's managing the staff and trying to, keep everyone focused. It's the busy season, so that's a big part of it too, is keeping everyone on track, eye on the prize. Summer's over, it's time to go.
Sounds like there's a lot of yelling going on.
A lot of yelling, yes.
But all right, but this has actually never been done that I'm aware of on this network. Jack, have we ever discussed five individual pasta kinds on one show?
I don't believe so.
What about across all the shows?
Maybe across all shows.
Perhaps.
We've got five different pastas. It's
okay.
possible.
Well, we're going to start, and I really like this, because there's probably an you know, a regional connection to each of these, mm-hmm. historical family businesses, mayors and senators are, you know, are all involved with, oh, we're in the home of gnocchi, or we're yeah. where Orecchietti is from. So let's start. We'll go in alphabetical order. Tell us about, Amatriciana.
The Bucatini Amatriciana.
But let me just preface. Lupa is known for its pasta. It's one of the few places where you can go and order a pepper and salt pasta.
Right.
And it comes out the way your grandmother would have made
exactly.
it.
Exactly. It's based upon very traditional Roman-style food. People have this misconception that Italians use lots of garlic, mm-hmm. you know, tons of basil and everything, which isn't necessarily the case. That's just the way it's been Americanized. A lot of time we'll use garlic as an infuser, but take it out of the sauce or take it out of the oil. Okay. So that's the kind of thing. So this, the Amatriciana comes from the Lazio region,
okay.
Which is where Rome is, central Italy. It comes from a town called Amatrice.
Huh.
It's a spicy tomato, pork, you know, pancetta, guanciale, which we get from Heritage, the jowls that we cure in-house. Chili, onions, tomato paste, tomato sauce. So it's got a little bit of the sweet, the spicy, the fatty. And it's kind of a rich sauce. So the bucatini is that long, hollowed-out pasta.
So the Amatriciana is made with the bucatini.
Made with the bucatini pasta, yeah. Because you need a noodle that's going to hold up to that thick sauce.
Is that how that region is for the most part? Are they eating heavy sausage?
Yeah, you know, not necessarily. But that's just one pasta that they've taken their pride in for, you know, God knows how many years. I read something about there's a town near Amatrice that makes a pasta. It's called Gricia, alla Gricia, and that's the same sauce without tomatoes.
Hmm.
So apparently that was before tomatoes were introduced to Europe from Africa. So it goes way back.
Way back.
There's all kinds of you go from one town to the next, and the sauce gets different and. People take pride in the way they make it and the different ways they make it. So,
have you been there and eaten pasta there?
I have not. I'm going to Italy in 2 weeks from tomorrow for my first trip.
Are you going through the restaurant group?
No, I'm getting married 2 weeks from today, So it's my honeymoon.
Very nice.
Yeah. Two for one. A little business, a little pleasure. So
she's like, why are we working? And
yeah.
You're like, I'm at an osteria eating pasta. This isn't work.
Come on. She knows what's happening.
She knows what's going on.
Yeah.
So let's go to Bavette Cacio Pepe.
The Cacio Pepe.
Tell us. Cacio is a type of cheese and
Cacio
pepe
just
pepper?
Cacio just means cheese in Italian. Pepe okay. means pepper.
I love this.
This is the most simple, ingredient-wise, this most simple pasta on the menu. Next to the aglio olio, but that's just oil and garlic. But this one is, it's the most simple, but the hardest one to make properly.
Interesting.
It's literally pepper, water, cheese, butter, and oil.
So there's no margin of error at all.
No margin. You have to have the exact amount of fat to non-fat, which is the water in this case, the right amount of pepper.
Sorry, can I just interrupt though? Absolutely. But do you use the pasta water? You would need
yes.
that, right? Because you want the starch?
A lot of the starch, but, towards the end, yes, to kind of help it all bind together. But if you use too much of the pasta water, then it becomes too salty. Because we use pecorino cheese, so and that's got a natural saltiness to it. So you got to watch how much pasta water you add to the sauce. Because if you're eating a whole bowl of this, you know, towards the end, you can kind of get that salty. You can't taste anything else but salt. But this is probably my favorite pasta at the restaurant because it's so hard for people to understand how difficult it is to make. But it's if you have the too much pepper, then all you can taste is pepper. And not enough pepper, then all you're eating is fat. You need to have the right amount of pepper to cut
now,
through
the fat
all the
comes
fat.
From what?
The cheese,
uh-huh.
the olive oil, and the butter.
Interesting.
The
now,
Holy Trinity.
Is this have a specific regional significance?
Anyway. That I'm not sure if. I know it's a very traditional Roman preparation. From what I've heard from, you know, from Cruz, the executive chef of Lupa, that you can go to Rome and you order a cacio pepe and they'll give you a bowl of pasta and on the side they'll give you cheese and pepper.
Oh, so you mix it yourself?
Which apparently is you know, I guess it's just being the lazy way of doing it. We know.
You do it for people.
We do it for people, and we make it the right way.
I wonder if they make cocktails for you there, and, or they just give you
a bunch of mixers. Ice, liquor, and a mixer on the side, and you can make whatever you want.
I mean, that probably is done everywhere, because pepper adds spice, cheese is not even a specific type of cheese, and bavette is just a form of pasta. What is it?
Yeah, it's a linguine. It's a long, flat pasta. Linguine has many different names depending on the region you go to. In northern Italy, like in Liguria, it's called Trinette. So it has different names depending on the region you go to. In Rome, it's bavette.
Now, before I ask you about the last three, are there rules for pasta? Like sometimes I'll tell Anne, like, don't put the long spaghettis with that sauce because it doesn't absorb correctly or stick to it. Was there rules with that?
There are, but those are just guidelines. Okay. I guess, like I mentioned before, the bucatini, you need kind of a thicker hollow pasta. That can hold up more to the thick tomato sauce. Right. That wouldn't be so gonna go so well with the cacio pepe. You need a thinner noodle that's gonna become one solid, one united mass. The bucatini will be noodles everywhere. So you have to have, there's some sauces, but you can always mix and match depending on what you like.
Take us through the world of gnocchi. One of your favorites.
Yeah, the gnocchi. I grew up eating potato, which most people are familiar with. The ones we make at Lupa are cheese. They're ricotta and goat curd.
Really? No
potato in the gnocchi.
Goat curd. So all the more reason that you supported the No Goat Left Behind.
Yeah,
absolutely. They're the behind your gnocchi.
You know it.
Where do you get goat curd?
We get ours from Coach Farms.
Uh-huh.
It's goat cheese. It's the same. It's just not as
fresh.
Yeah, exactly.
Connection to Mario there, right? His wife.
His wife owns that one. Yep. Her family does. Yeah. So that one
Miles
is that one comes with a fennel sausage ragu.
Mm-hmm.
Pork and fennel is a very traditional combination in Italy. The pork from Heritage. That's we take all the any kind of scrap we have left over and we make a ragu out of it and. It's tomato based. We take tomato sauce and reduce it way down, so it's almost like tomato paste, mirepoix mixed in there, and it's delicious. It's
fennel is such an interesting thing. I mean, it holds up in sausages. It's it's an underlying consistent flat thing in so many foods.
And there's so many different forms of fennel. You get fennel seed, fennel pollen, fennel flower, the bulb. Even the anise seed has similar flavors to it. It's a wonderful.
What's it taste like just in and of itself, like out of the what? Out of a bush?
The bulb comes out of the ground and you get all the flowers, the fronds, they take the pollen from the flowers and all that stuff. It's licorice. It's that's the flavor, Zambuca.
One of the oldest vegetables cultivated. It was cited in Roman banquets way back when.
Way back in the day.
Very interesting. Yeah. So take me to the cavatelli pasta. What does it look like?
Cavatelli looks like a little, kind of like a shell, I guess you could say. I believe cavatelli comes from a Latin word meaning to hollow out. I'm not 100% sure on that.
Interesting.
But
you were alive back then, is that right?
Absolutely, Patrick. I span the centuries.
Yeah. cavatelli, that's more of a specialty pasta we do at the restaurant because it's very time consuming. We actually currently right now we have a cavatelli machine that was my grandfather's that he brought over here from Italy.
Really? That's cool. You brought it up.
He passed away 2 or 3 years ago and I raided his basement and took some things and that was one of the things
that
I
awesome,
took.
That's awesome, man.
Jack,
could you delete that?
Yeah.
Cuz that sounds illegal.
But the thing is the machine is in great condition because he never used it. He always made his cavatelli by hand using a wire. So the machine had all this old flour from the 50s, but he never used it. So it's in pretty good form. But the cavatelli, it's got different names in different regions. Sometimes if you go to Sardinia, they call it gnocchetti or maleratus or something like that. It's an eggless, potatoless dough, and then it's just rolled into that shape. So you could put any kind of different flours or ratios in there. Uh-huh. It's a great vehicle for butter sauces and stuff like that.
Because
the shell soaks up all the sauce.
Yeah, it's a peas and cream.
Right.
My mom used to make me that, and she would always say, you need the shells for this.
Soaks it up. Gets all that sauce in there.
Tell us finally about orecchiette, and then we're going to have three questions for you.
Yeah, orecchiette. Not related to pasta. Orecchiette. One of the harder ones, very time consuming. That's also an eggless dough. Orecchiette means little ears, Italian.
It seems like it's almost everyone's favorite because it's served with sausage and rabe.
Yeah, that's a very traditional preparation. We take the same sausage that we use for the gnocchi ragu, which is a combination of pork shoulder and the jowl, the guanciale, and we make one of the more delicious sauces. It's sausage and butter and cheese and oil. It's a combination of, you know, like a cacio pepe, I guess you could say, or a variation of it. And we have a guy who it takes him quite a while to handle that one. That one's also not on the menu, but it's special because we couldn't keep up with the production of it.
Well, that's amazing how much pork you guys go through. I mean, thousands of pounds of pork shoulder.
Yeah, we go through quite a bit of pork over there, and you know, but it's not like in your face. It's small amounts, you know, small quantities of it, and in each portion. But you definitely know it's there.
So I wanted to ask you, since you're a sous chef, how long is the lifespan of a sous chef in New York City, and in the rest, you know, this specific place, in the rest of the country, and in the world, which I guess means Italy and France.
I mean, I guess it's hard to say because, you know, I've only been a sous chef for a couple of years now, but I feel as though people aren't necessarily putting in the correct amount of time or the appropriate amount of time as a sous chef. They try to jump up from line cook to sous chef to chef to do their own thing, and that's good for, I guess, short term, but if you want to be successful long term, you have to kind of work yourself through the ranks, get a firm understanding and a firm grasp on what you're doing, and then move up to each level as you go.
God, I hope Joe, Mario, Mark, and Cruz are listening right now. That's good.
But again, so what do you think is the timeline for that? Like, you've been a sous chef for, what did you say, 2 years?
Almost 2 years, yeah. Uh-huh. So how many years? I've been a little bit for a year and a half. I was line cook for 4 years, uh-huh, and then sous chef. I feel as though you got to be a sous chef longer so you can get a grasp on the management side of it. The, you know, when you go from line cook to sous chef, you have to use your head a lot more. You have to think more. As a line cook, you just, someone shows you how to make something and you just do it.
You have to manage too.
Right. So as a sous chef, you have to, it's the time where you want to practice the food that you want to do, get the flavor combinations right, and all that kind of stuff. So I can't really put a time frame on. It depends on where you work and what kind of food you're doing and all that kind of stuff. But I would say at least, you know, four or five years.
Mm-hmm. Are there things you still haven't learned yet?
Absolutely.
You that are hard to perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Just the potato gnocchi, for example, is one of those temperamental things depending on, you know, the humidity of the day in the kitchen, how the potatoes are reacting, all that kind of stuff. So you have to try these things over and over and over again, perfect them, because you may get them down a couple times, and then years down the road, you'll be making them for your menu at your restaurant or whatever, and they won't come out. They'll be gummy because you didn't have that time to practice. Right now is the time to practice those things when you're still managing a restaurant and still trying to, you know, figure out, mess with the specials and all that kind of stuff. So
this is why I specialize. My one specialty is medieval food. Mm-hmm. So if it tastes absolutely horrible, I'm just like, oh, that's how they ate it. If it's super gummy, I'm like, they like gummy.
That's how they liked
then.
It. Yeah. Yeah.
So talking about old school, talk to us about Naples and its importance in food and to you, because this is where you're from, right?
Oh, my grandparents were from a town called village called Squillani. It's about an hour north east of Naples. So a lot of the food growing up that I ate was Naples-ish, I guess you could say. It wasn't necessarily pizza and fried seafood all the time, but it was definitely had some accents of Naples in it. I'm looking forward to going there in a couple weeks. We're going to spend a couple of days in Naples and try to get out. My family actually owns my grandparents' property in Italy, so I'm going to have a chance to go out there and check that out.
Are you going to be driving out there?
No, I got some cousins that are going to be chauffeuring us around.
A good way to practice driving in Naples is to drive through midtown New York City traffic at 60 miles an hour and just see what you have to do to not slow down.
Yeah, no, I mean, the coffee. Everyone knows that Naples has the best coffee in Italy. I don't want to keep talking about all these things, but I also took an espresso pot from my grandfather's basement, and I used that to make espresso at home, and
oh, man.
Nothing makes me happier than a nice...
What kind of espresso pot is it?
It's one of those, it's the one where you I don't know the name of it exactly.
You boil it up from the bottom.
It's like, it comes up from the bottom, put the water in the bottom, and then the coffee in the middle, and then up top, and it makes two
and
shots
two
of espresso.
Two silver things that screw in.
Yep, I don't know the name of that, I probably should, but I had two this morning, two cups of espresso. Just to get me here.
Yeah, your eyes are popping out. No. Yeah. But, and then pizza, of course,
pizza,
right?
Pizza, yep. Pizza, it didn't come from Naples, but they perfected it. I've heard things that pizza originated in China. I'm not sure if that's true or not. But Naples perfected it with the coal ovens and all that stuff.
Then there's a third food, right? That they can.
I believe it's the second or third most trafficked seafood port in Europe.
Huh.
They have tons of fresh seafood, lots of fried food in Naples. They have the carts in the street where you can get the fried food. But they perfected the pizza. They turned it into what it is today, the margherita and the marinara, which. I believe the margherita pizza is named after one of the king's wives.
Yeah, I think that they make
ago.
It for one of the queens or something.
They turned it, they wanted the basil, the tomato, and the cheese supposed to represent the flag.
The flag, exactly.
And then the marinara is for the fishermen. So there's actually no fish in the marinara sauce, but it's named after the mariners or the fishermen. So.
Well, you got to come back post-trip.
A lot. Oh, yeah, I'll be here.
So we'll look forward
for a full report.
Yeah, well, tell us anything else happening in the future. I mean, you're getting married now, then you're going
to
Italy.
Yes, getting married, going to Italy for the honeymoon, and then do a little research and development and... Like I said before, enjoy the trip. So
I guess the email invite must have gotten bounced back from me.
I sent it to you.
Oh, okay, you did. Good. Yeah,
once,
it's so funny.
When we got engaged a year ago, I sent it to you right after that.
I got to check my friggin' email.
Check your spam.
A lot of bounce back.
Check
probably
your spam.
My spam filter, yeah.
Yeah, that happens.
Anyway, well, this has been a very, very good show. And I really thank you for coming on. That's
Thanks for having me.
Fascinating. I would love to do this more often, just step
Let
by
me
step.
Know.
You really know your stuff about this. And are you at the pasta station, or do you oversee it?
The sous chefs and crews, we oversee the whole line, so we have our hands on every dish that go out of the kitchen, but we're standing
clean.
Right next to the pasta. Yeah. It's clean, don't worry. Not physically having our hands there, but we're seeing everything that goes out, I guess you could say. So pasta is what we do there, and it's what we take pride in, and I love it.
And we're going to be doing putting a lot of energy into promoting Lupa, as well as a few other restaurants that are supporting the No Goat Left Behind project.
Yep.
So thank you for supporting that.
Very,
and thanks for
very
coming
rarely
on.
Do I get to comment on a restaurant, but I actually have dined at Lupa and I loved it. So
that seems to be the consensus. Everyone seems to enjoy it. So.
And yet you've never been reviewed.
We're okay with that.
I know.
We don't need the we don't need
crazy.
The review.
I know. It makes no sense.
I know. Yeah. Oh, well.
How many people go in there? How old? It's like an institution. It's also work.
I mean, I used to eat there all the time before I got the job there. So when I got the job there, I was super excited.
Someone's going to come in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, well, Sam Sifton's leaving now. So
yes,
it'll be
I heard.
Probably the new, maybe Sam, well, you would know if he was going to do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I would. He'd tell everybody on Twitter or something.
Anyway, I wonder if the new food reviewer is going to be recognizable, like someone who people know what he looks like. Or like
I hope
Bruni.
Not.
Yeah.
I think that the quiet, stealthy way that Bruni used to do it was, it kept the restaurant on edge, and it was the right way to review a restaurant as opposed to posting it all over the place and... But everyone's got their own style.
I won't tell the name of the restaurant, but it was a very good French restaurant. I went into their coat check, off hours because I was making a delivery, and they had a little picture of Frank Bruni.
Yeah, every restaurant's host stand or in the office had the Frank Bruni picture.
I'm like the pressure on that poor coat check
I know,
person
right?
if they screw
Staring
up.
Staring everyone's face and they
like,
come
What if
in?
He's not wearing a coat? Anyway. Well, thanks so much for
thanks
listening.
Thanks for having me.
And we will be back next week. And by the way, Jack, who sponsored us today?
Hurst Ranch.
Hurst Ranch. Brian Kenny and Steve Hurst out on the West Coast. Thanks to them, too. All right. Have a great week, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The Heritage Meat Shop has just opened in the Essex Street Market. Open from 9 to 7 Monday through Saturday and 10 to 6 on Sundays, the Heritage Meat Shop supports independent family farms and animal welfare approved and certified humane raising standards. Most importantly, they offer a wide variety of heritage breeds. So stop by, get a sandwich, try the charcuterie, the Heritage Meat Shop at the Essex Street Market. The following is a message from Heritage Foods USA. 14 family farms and over 50 restaurants have committed to participation in No Goat Left Behind, a new program developed by Heritage Foods USA, a meat distribution company dedicated to preserving endangered breeds. Without an end market, the majority of male dairy goats are sold into the commodity market or killed at birth. Dairy farmers are always struggling with feed prices, milk prices, and weather. Goats usually have twins or triplets, and for every female who will become a milker, there is a male buckling who will become a financial drain. It makes no sense that these males are sold into the commodity market or put to death when the United States imports almost 50% of its annual goat supply. Home consumers interested in participating can order goats through heritagefoodsusa.com. They will receive goats via FedEx, and home delivery is available for New York City customers. In addition to the goat, these packages will also include recipes and a DVD featuring interviews with the farmers, processors, and chefs demonstrating how to break down and cook goat. Again, for more information on No Goat Left Behind, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com or call Aaron Fairbanks at 718-389-0985.